Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Numbers chapter 5. I'm going to do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 31. We will look at unclean people. We will look at confession and restitution. And we will look at the famous trial by ordeal for women who have committed adultery. Our context is this. In the last chapter, we looked at the duties of the Kohathites, the Gershonites, and the Merarites in carrying the tabernacle from place to place. So let's start now in Numbers 5, 1 through 4. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the sons of Israel that they send away from the camp every leper, that's one with a skin disease, and everyone having a discharge, and everyone who was unclean because of a dead person. That leper is a really bad translation. The Holman Christian Study Bible has skin disease. So everybody has a skin disease. Everyone has a discharge. That would be seminal discharges for men, or pus or bloody discharge for a man, or for a woman too, for that matter. Everyone who was unclean because of a dead person, the normal case there would be somebody handling a dead body in a funeral, and they would become Levitically unclean. Now, we already know that they can't participate in the tabernacle. We've seen that in Leviticus. But now they're also sent outside the camp. The camp is where the people lived in their tents around the tabernacle. They're sent outside the camp. Verse 3, you shall send away both male and female. You shall send them outside the camp so that they will not defile their camp where I dwell in their midst. Remember, the tabernacle was literally in the midst of all the 12 tribes of Israel. We talked all about that in Numbers chapter 4 and chapter 3. Chapter 2 maybe, I can't remember, in the previous chapters. Tabernacle's in the midst of all the 12 tribes of Israel. The Levites being the closest encirclement around the tabernacle. Verse 4, the sons of Israel did so and sent them outside the camp, just as the Lord had spoken to Moses, thus the sons of Israel did. Miriam was put out of camp because of this law in Numbers 5, 1 through 4, because she had skin disease. Remember, she rebelled against Moses, and as a result, God put that white, made her skin white with disease. Numbers 12, 14, second part of the verse, let her be shut up for 7 days outside the camp, and afterward she may be received again. Outside the camp, that's where uncleanliness goes. Now, this putting people outside the camp is easy to understand when the camp of Israel was planted in one place when it was stationed there. But when they were traveling, if something broke out, like a skin disease or something, they would have to travel outside the camp. Apparently, they journeyed together outside the camp. So they journeyed outside the camp and camped outside the camp, I think. I didn't read that anywhere, but that's just my opinion. Why were they sent outside the camp? Well, Adam Clark says because diseases were contagious. Well, that's true. There's always a physical aspect to this, but the main reason is spiritual. Physical death, physical disease symbolized unholiness, because that's what unholiness brings about, physical death and disease. So if somebody is physically sick with a discharge outside the camp, God wants to keep the camp holy. Now, a place was made for the sick outside the camp. This was not inhumane by any means. Basically like a quarantine. Here's Adam Clark's quote. Each camp had a space behind it and on one side, whither the infected might be removed, and where probably convenient places were erected for the accommodation of the infected. For we cannot suppose that they were driven out into the naked wilderness. No, I don't suppose that. Clark in another place says, quote, this is the earliest account we have of such separations, and probably this ordinance gave the first idea of a hospital, where all those who are afflicted with contagious disorders are put into particular wards under medical treatment. We go down to Numbers 5, verses 5 through 7. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, when a man or woman commits any of the sins of mankind, acting unfaithfully against the Lord, and that person is guilty, then he shall confess his sins which he has committed, and he shall make restitution in full for his wrong, and add to it one-fifth of it, and give it to him whom he has wronged. Well, first of all, what is a sin of mankind? When a man or woman commits any of the sins of mankind, the NIV translates that, when a man or woman wrong another in any way. The NIV note has an alternate translation, when a man or woman, quote, commits any wrong common to mankind. In other words, when they sin, when they commit a misdemeanor or a felony or a crime against each other. So what we see now, verses 1 through 4, talked about outwardly unclean persons, people with a discharge, people who touched a dead body and so forth, people who have a skin disease. Now we're moving in these verses, verses 5 through 7, to inwardly unclean persons, people who've committed sins. And by the way, these are not just sins. These are sins against other people, because we see restitution is required, restitution plus one-fifth. Now, these sins of mankind, which are committed against other people that require restitutions, are also said to be against the Lord. When a man or a woman commits any of the sins of mankind acting unfaithfully against the Lord, when you commit a crime or a slander or an evil deed to your fellow man, you are not only sinning against him, you're sinning against the God who made that other man or woman in his image. Remember when David, referring to his sin against Uriah the Hittite, he murdered him so he could commit adultery with Uriah's wife, which is pretty disgusting. He's very sorry for what he had done. In Psalms 51:4, he says this to God, "Against you, you only I have sinned." Well, David's probably overstating the case. He sinned against Uriah by getting him killed. But what he's saying is, ultimately, it was you I sinned against. Against you I have sinned and done what is evil in your sight. So when that person who sins, he acts unfaithfully against the Lord, and that person is guilty. Now, what does it mean to be guilty? Well, it could refer to objective guilt, or Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest it could be subjective guilt. Well, I say it's both. That person is objectively guilty, hopefully he subjectively knows he's guilty. Verse 7, "Then he shall confess his sins which he has committed." Well, who does he confess his sins to? Well, he could confess his sins to the wronged person. It could mean he's supposed to confess his sins to God, or it could mean he's supposed to confess his sins to the Levitical priest. Maybe it could be to all of the above. I think that would be the best way to interpret that. "And then he shall make restitution in full for his wrong." Adam Clark says, without restitution, there can be no mercy expected from God. Restitution's a big deal. When you mess over somebody, you need to make it right, plus 20%. That's what they had to do. They had one-fifth. Let's say you stole a sheep. Well, let's say, no, that's a bad example, because I'll tell you why in a minute. But let's say that you, what did you do? Let's say that you stole some wheat out of the wheat field from your neighbor. Well, you need to pay it back, plus 20%. What's the purpose of that one-fifth extra that you have to make restitution with? Well, first of all, it creates deterrence. Without that one-fifth penalty, people could just steal something and replace it with impunity. Say, I got it, but maybe I'll get caught. I feel a little bit bad about it. I'll give it back to him. Well, just giving it back doesn't really deter somebody from taking it, because he's not going to lose anything. He takes 100% and gives back 100%. What has he lost? But if he takes 100% and gives back 120%, the thief has lost something, or the fraudster has lost something. And besides, just replacing the loss doesn't compensate the victim for the time, the trouble, and emotional distress that has to be spent in order to deal with the fraud or with the theft. Now, this idea of restitution plus one-fifth is mentioned earlier in the law in Leviticus. We read in Leviticus 5:16, "He must make restitution for his sin regarding any holy thing, adding a fifth of its value to it, and give it to the priest. Then the priest will make atonement on his behalf with the ram of the restitution offering, and he will be forgiven." The restitution offering, that's the Holman Christian Study Bible. That's really a trespass offering. King James, guilt offering, ESV and ASB, Holman Christian Study Bible, a guilt offering. So your typical offering that's given when something is stolen from somebody, or when you hurt somebody, you defraud him or you defame him or something like that, you have to offer a trespass offering, and you make restitution to the victim if possible. Sometimes it's not possible, but if possible, and you add 20% to the value that you damaged him. Leviticus 6 verses 2 through 5. The holy things there mentioned in Leviticus 5:16 were the things of the tabernacle that the priests weren't supposed to touch, or that non-priests weren't supposed to touch. And there were so many things they could make a mistake about that there was a chance for them to rid themselves of their sin by offering a trespass, a guilt offering. So that holy thing refers to the things of the tabernacle, such as the table of showbread, the table of the bread of the presence, the seven-branch candlestick, the bronze laver, the bronze sea, and all that. If you touch it by mistake, you've sinned against the holy thing, you make restitution. Now, I don't know how you make the fifth of the value. Maybe, for example, somebody touched a sacrificial lamb or bullock and made it unclean, and so it couldn't be offered. Well, in that case, you have to find you another lamb or cow, sell it, and then add 20% of the value to the priest. Now, here's another example of making restitution plus 20%. Leviticus chapter 6, verses 2 through 5. "When someone sins and offends the Lord by deceiving his neighbor in regard to a deposit, a security, or a robbery or defrauds his neighbor. In other words, a secure deposit, you don't give it back when you're supposed to. You just outright steal something, or you defraud your neighbor somehow, or find something lost and lies about it. You don't return the bailed good. In other words, if you find it, you're the bailor. You need to return it to the bailee. And if you don't, you're guilty. Or you swear falsely about any of the sinful things a person may do. Once he has sinned and acknowledged his guilt, he must return what he stole or defrauded or the deposit entrusted him or the lost item he found or anything else about which he swore falsely. He must make full restitution for it and add a fifth of its value to it. He is to pay to its owner on the day he acknowledges his guilt. Now, that's the standard law. And by the way, you constantly hear things like, the trespass offering was only for unintentional sins, and there was no offering in the Old Testament sacrificial system for intentional sins. That is a myth. It is not true. Leviticus 6 right here is talking about trespass offerings, guilt offerings, and the examples they give for when a guilt offering is needed and when restitution needs to be made and when 20% needs to be added is talking about intentional theft. Deceive your neighbor in regard to a deposit, that's negligent, that's accidental, A robbery? Really? That's accidental and unintentional? You defraud your neighbor unintentionally? No. These are intentional sins and they were covered by trespass offerings. I don't know where people get that. I think what they do is read Leviticus 5:16, and those, when you sin against the holy thing of the tabernacle, it's done unintentionally. You don't mean to touch it. And so that trespass offering, guilt offering, would cover an unintentional violation of the Levitical law. That's true, but it also covers intentional things too. Now, we have one more problem about this 20% restitution, and that comes from Exodus 22, verse 1. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for the ox and 4 oxen for the sheep. Well, that's not 120% restitution. You have to give 5 oxen back for 1 oxen. That's 500% restitution. You steal a sheep and it's slaughtered and sold. That's 400% restitution. Now, the percentage of restitution is different if the ox or the sheep has not been slaughtered, not been stolen. That's an interesting discussion in itself, which I won't get into. But the point is that here we don't have 120%. Well, how do you make the distinction? Well, John Gill says that Numbers 5:7, the verse we're on now, is requiring restitution for frauds, fraudulent activity, whereas Exodus 22:1 is talking about flagrant theft, because it says if a man steals an ox or a sheep, I don't see how Jameson, Foss, and Brown can make that distinction, because in Leviticus 6:2-5, it says a robbery when someone sins and offends his Lord in regard to a robbery. That's theft. So I don't think that makes a distinction. Leviticus 5:6 requires restitution for sins of mankind, which includes robbery, and Exodus 22:1 is talking about robbery. So what's the difference? Also, Leviticus 6:2-5 requires restitution for robbery explicitly stated. So what's the difference between Leviticus 6:2-5 requiring restitution for robbery and Exodus 22:1 requiring restitution for robbery? That doesn't distinguish it. I don't know where Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown get the idea that it does. So I looked in the commentaries for this, and naturally, as so often happens, the commentators don't feel fit to discuss this weighty problem. So I'm going to have to speculate myself. My first speculation is perhaps stealing sacrificial animals is a special case. Exodus 22:1 therefore requires a stiffer restitution for these special sacrificial animals, oxen and sheep. Problem with that, though, is Exodus 22:4 includes donkeys in with the animals that require more than 120% restitution. Let me say this. An ox, if it had not been sold or sacrificed, if it was still in the thief's possession, the restitution was 2 oxes, 200%. Same thing for sheep, same thing for donkeys, same thing for any animal. However, if the animal that was stolen has been sacrificed or fenced, sold to someone else, then it's 5 oxen for the stolen ox and 4 oxen for the stolen sheep. The donkeys are not mentioned. So there's reasons for that, mainly because if once the animal is stolen or sacrificed, there can't be restitution made. It's harder for the victim to get his animal back and so forth. So the penalty, somebody that steals something and then fences it is guilty of 2 crimes, theft and fencing, selling stolen goods. So the restitution is steeper. But that's not the problem here. The problem is why is, in any case, whether it's 200% for double ox, a double donkey, a double sheep, or five oxen or four sheep, why is the restitution so much more than 120%, 500%, 400%, 200%? Why? Well, it's not because Exodus 22:4 is trying to deal with sacrificial animals and makes a special case of it, because donkeys aren't sacrificed. So this is my last speculation. Perhaps stealing animals in general is a special case that requires extra restitution because animals are so important to an agricultural economy. Honestly, I don't know. That's just the best I can do with that. We go now to Numbers 5, verse 8. But if the man has no relative to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution which is made for the wrong must go to the Lord for the priest, besides the ram of atonement, by which atonement is made for him. If the man has no relative, how could that be? The offended man could die before the restitution could be made, and then he doesn't have any relatives. So there's nobody to give the restitution to. Or maybe he's Adam Clark and John Gill says maybe he's a proselyte with no relatives, but I don't know why that would matter, because you could always give the restitution to the proselyte. I don't know. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's basically a dead victim with no relatives. The restitution goes to the priest. That makes sense. What about this? Could the verse refer to a capital offense, the victim having died? Let's say you're swinging the axe, you're negligent, the axe head comes off, you clobber the victim, you kill him. Now you can't give him restitution because he's kaputsky, he shuffled off his mortal coil, and the victim doesn't have any relatives. Well, then you would give the money to the priest. Of course, you got to figure out what the man's earnings were worth and add 20% to it. Well, that would be the case of an unintentional sin. What happens if somebody intentionally murdered somebody? Well, of course, that's something that would require the homicidal, the killer, to go to the city of refuge. Actually, the cities of refuge were for unintentional sins. An intentional murder, he would probably be subject to the tender mercies of the kinsman redeemer. So I don't think that this verse here, talking about making restitution, I don't think you make restitution to a kinsman redeemer or to a deceased victim, because you're going to get killed by the deceased victim. And if it's an unintentional homicide, negligence, manslaughter, well, then you go to the cities of refuge. You don't really make restitution. That's my feeling as for how this would work. But if there's no relative in general, the restitution goes to the priest. And then, of course, you have to give a ram of atonement to the priest. The ram of atonement is a guilt offering. This is a standard male sheep ram. That's the only animal that was offered for trespass offerings. And trespass offerings were for sins of brother against brother, man against man. You can read all about trespass offerings or guilt offerings, depending on how you want to translate it, in Leviticus 5, Leviticus 6, and Leviticus 7. We go now to Numbers 5, 9, and 10. Also, every contribution pertaining to all the holy gifts of the sons of Israel, which they offer to the priest, shall be his. So every man's holy gifts shall be his, i.e. the priest. Whatever any man gives to the priest, it becomes his. Now, these holy gifts is talking about the parts of the sacrifice which were waved or heaved. The breast of a animal for a peace offering is waved before the altar, left and right mainly, and the right foreleg, which was given to the officiating priest of a peace offering animal, was heaved up and down. I realize that people disagree exactly what waving and heaving meant, but that's kind of the general idea. And the priest, of course, got to eat all that stuff, and this verse says all that stuff is his. Well, now, why is that repeated? The priest gets his stuff. We saw that all through the book of Leviticus. He also gets the first fruits, as Adam Clark says. He also gets tithes. Every tenth animal that passes under the stick belongs to the priest. All that's his, so why repeat it? Since it seems obvious, what's the purpose of stating that the priest's contributions belong to them? Well, John Gill speculates the reason for the repetition here is that the priest personally officiating doesn't have to divide his gifts among the priestly corps. He gets to keep it individually. He doesn't have to spread it out amongst all his fellow priests. Well, that could be. But I think a better answer, in my opinion, is just he just wants to, God through Moses wants to emphasize Numbers 5:8. Restitution offerings go to the priest if there's no relative to receive the restitution, and all the other holy gifts, these sacrifices that are legally allocated to the priest, he's going to get those too, just a reinforcement. We go now to Numbers 5:11 through 14. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, If any man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him, and a man has intercourse with her, and it is hidden from the eyes of her husband, and she is undetected, although she has defiled herself, and there is no witness against her, and she has not been caught in the act, If a spirit of jealousy comes over him and he is jealous of his wife when she has defiled herself, or if a spirit of jealousy comes over him and he is jealous of his wife when she has not defiled herself, and I'll stop it in the middle of the sentence here, this is the famous ordeal by jealousy, or ordeal of jealousy. And when we go through this, it seems like the weirdest thing in the world, but we'll see there's reason behind it. The purpose of this little ritual was twofold. One, to encourage women not to commit adultery on their husbands. And two, to encourage husbands not to make some stupid cockeyed accusation of his wife when she hasn't done anything wrong. Maybe she's just friendly with some man or something, and the insecure, jealous husband says, you're sleeping with him. I'm going to divorce you. Remember, you know, it was fairly easy to get a divorce back then. You know, he said, I don't trust you. Bang, out you go. So the purpose was for twofold, to inhibit wives' adultery, and two, to inhibit jealous husbands from making false accusations of adultery against his wife. We'll see how as we go through. Now, this undetected adultery here is now an example of hidden uncleanness, and the NIV Study Bible says that what we see here is a movement from more open uncleanness, robbery, fraudulent activities, and so forth. So now we're talking about hidden uncleanness. Actually, the movement is this. From the very first of the chapter, we're talking about obvious physical things, leprosy, skin diseases, and discharges. And then we go to fraudulent wrongs, which are clearly wrong in public. And now we're talking about secret adulterous affairs, unhidden sin. And these are the hardest ones to prove, hardest ones to deal with. Now, this chapter is not for certain adultery, not for adultery which is certain, for which there is plain proof. And that case is very simple. If the wife did that, the husband could put her away, but actually there's no need to do that. He can just go to the courts and the woman is executed. Leviticus 20:10, if there's a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. So we're not talking about that. This is when there is a case where the woman has not been caught in flagrante delicto, where she hasn't been caught in the act. The man's just jealous of her. He's not sure what she's doing. He sees some text messages which are a little bit friendly, a little bit ambiguous. Not sexting, but just a little bit chummy. So he gets jealous. Now, before this ordeal is carried out by the priest, what level of jealousy must the man have before he can bring a case against his wife before the priest? Well, Gill, it seems to me, says that the man must have good cause to be jealous before he can bring a case against his wife. He just can't say, I'm mad at her today. I'm going to bring a case. We'll see later that he's got good incentive not to do that. But also legally, he probably had to have probable cause. Now, Gill quotes a lot of Jewish writers who also presume the same way. And I realize rabbis aren't the scripture, but it's a reasonable interpretation, I think, to say that he's got to have a good cause before he can try his wife for adultery. Now, he might not have any hard evidence. He doesn't have any text message on the phone that says, I shacked up with him. He doesn't have that. He has no eyewitness. He has not seen anything, but he's jealous. Now, the NIV Study Bible says these feelings of jealousy may have been provoked on the basis of good cause. In other words, he might be jealous for a reason. He starts noticing his wife's a little cold. She's not putting out for him on her allotted night of connubial bliss. And he might have good reason. And so this is all speculation, but I think it's reasonable. The man who wants to bring his wife up on charges of adultery has got to go to the judges and say, look, I have good reason to be jealous. I don't have hard evidence, but she's not acting right. We've been getting along fine for years, and all of a sudden now she's cold. You know, she's got to have at least probable cause. Maybe not hard proof, but probable cause. Now, the NIV Study Bible makes the point that this chapter, this trial by ordeal, is designed to prevent unfounded charges of unfaithfulness. Now, why is that? Well, if you bring, let's say you don't really have reason to suspect your wife, but you're mad at her, so you bring a charge of adultery against her just to show her. Well, now what happens? If she's proven guilty, she's going to get executed and you just lost your wife. And it also proves that you're a cuckold. Some other man has stolen your wife's affection from you, and you're a loser as a husband. That's one bad thing. Or she could be found to be innocent, in which case you have just been shown up to the whole community as somebody going around is so insecure and so jealous that you accuse your wife falsely of jealousy. What kind of a husband are you anyway? So there's not going to be frivolous cases here. In fact, some people say this trial was probably hardly ever appealed to because it's such a big deal. So the man's got to be pretty sure his wife's committing adultery, and he's got to be sure that he's also got to have no evidence. He's got to take the risk that she could come out of this trial by ordeal innocent, and then he's going to look bad. And he's also got to be willing to lose her, because the law says if she's guilty of adultery, she and her adulterous buddy are going to be executed. Now, I said another purpose of the trial by ordeal here, the adultery ordeal, another advantage of it from a social happiness point of view is that it discourages the adultery on the part of a woman. Because a woman is thinking about committing adultery and she says, but boy, if my husband, he doesn't have to have hard evidence, but if he just starts suspecting me, he can bring me up on a trial by ordeal and I'm going to have to be exposed before the whole community. I'm going to have to ask God to curse me. And God will probably curse me for committing adultery, and I'm going to die a horrible death. That would make you think twice about straying from the straight and narrow, would it not? Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown combines both of these reasons for the trial by ordeal in this quotation, quote, "This law was given both as a strong discouragement to conjugal infidelity on the part of a wife and a sufficient protection of her from the consequences of a hasty and groundless suspicion on the part of the husband." I said earlier that this trial by jealousy is so severe and so terrible it was probably never appealed to. Adam Clark agrees with that. He says, quote, "There is no instance in the scriptures of this kind of ordeal having ever been resorted to, and it probably never was. I suspect it wasn't. However, it served as a powerful deterrent. It deterred husbands from unjustly accusing their wives." Without this trial ordeal, a husband could go to his buddies in the gate and say, "My wife's shacking up on me. She's running around on me. I'm going to get rid of her." And the wife would have no defense. But with this trial by ordeal, the wife says, "Okay, you think that I'm catting around on you? I deny it, and I'm going to get a trial by ordeal, and I'll publicly prove to you I wasn't running around on you." Ooh, that's going to keep the husband's mouth when he's sitting in the gate gossiping with his buddies. He's going to keep quiet about his wife's alleged adultery. A false accusation will make the husband look vindictive and foolish when the woman is vindicated. And, of course, it's the trial by jealousy. It was a powerful deterrent against adultery on the part of the wife, as I just mentioned. Now, we are confronted with a strange fact. Why is there not a trial of jealousy for the man? Well, here's some reasons. First reason, there needed to be a way for the husband to know the paternity of his children. Now, think about that. If a wife commits adultery, the man doesn't even know whether her kids are his or not. Ooh, that's serious business, especially in a society that is very, very big on inheritance and tribal unity and all that, as you read the Old Testament. So a man needed to know the paternity of his children. And then if he starts to be jealous of his wife and begin to wonder if she's catting around, now he can't be sure if his own kids are his. Ooh, that can mess up a family big time. Now contrast that with a wife. Let's say her husband commits adultery. She doesn't. She's a faithful wife, but she's suspicious of her husband committing adultery. Well, if her husband commits adultery, that's a shame. It's bad, but as far as the children are concerned, she knows the children are hers. Can't be anybody else's because the only person she's having sex with is her husband. So she doesn't have to worry about the descendants. All right. So that's one reason why there was a trial of jealousy for the woman and not for the man. John Gill says this, "Damage to families was worse when women committed adultery." And that's similar to what I just said because then you don't know about who the father is and who the children are. Here's another reason that John Gill gives is that women then were more prone to adultery than men. Now, I don't know about this, but this is what his reasoning is. Women had an extraordinary desire to have children back then. Well, we know that's true. They died to have a child. And let's say the husband's impotent or he's got something wrong with him and she's not getting pregnant. So she says, "I think I'm going to go out and get pregnant with somebody else." And then everybody will think it's my husband's child. Yeah, maybe so. John Gill also says, this is my idea, actually. Husbands were polygamous, so they had no need of adultery. What do they need to commit adultery for? They got legalized adultery right there in their own house. Two or three nice, nubile women. His wife, he gets mad at his wife. He goes and gets a substitute right there in the tent. Wives can't do that, though, because it was not a polyandrous society. So if they get emotionally discontent, they could go out and find happiness elsewhere. Now, because that women were more prone to adultery, innocent wives were more apt to fall under suspicion than innocent husbands. And so innocent wives needed a way to clear themselves with this trial by jealousy. Well, that's speculation. I don't know whether it's true or not, but it's interesting. Now, here is the best reason to explain why there was no trial by jealousy for a man. This is from Colin Delitzsch. When the adulteress faces the ordeal, she had to have committed adultery with somebody. And when she is confronted by her husband, maybe she confesses when confronted. She says, I don't want to go through the ordeal. I confess it. I don't know why she would, because she might have to get killed. She might say to her husband, yeah, I did it, but please don't turn me over to the courts. They'll kill me. And the husband might say, okay. Or maybe she says, no, I'm going to go through the ordeal. She fails the ordeal. That means that the person that she had committed adultery with would probably be caught. She'd probably confess it. Because the judges would say, okay, Susie Q., you failed the ordeal, so we know you committed adultery. Who did you do it with? Put a little heat on her, maybe? A little enhanced interrogation techniques? I don't know how they get it out of her, but she could turn over her male adulterer friend, and he would be caught, and then he would be executed. So, anyway, this delivers the law from the charge of sexism. The reason for it, you know, people love, oh, God, it's a sexist, you know, you liberal idiots out there. They're everywhere. They love to not submit themselves to God and think they're smarter than God is. Albright, the famous commentator, says that we need to contrast the Roman and Sharia law about this. Under those systems, the husband had the right to take private action. He could murder his wife if he got jealous of her. But under Jewish law, the husband could not take private action. He had to go to the courts and turn over the decision to the courts and to God. The husband could not take private action. So you see, this law is better than all the other ancient laws. Now, I mentioned earlier that the trial by ordeal would discourage husbands from making rash, unfounded charges of adultery against his wife. How might that be? Let's look at some commentators on that. Matthew Henry says this, no guilty woman would take such an awful oath of imprecation on herself. She's calling God down on her head to curse herself. Now, if an innocent woman got up and says, may God curse me if I committed adultery, I didn't, and then she passes the trial, her stomach doesn't swell up, she's innocent. Ooh, but she was willing to risk the curse of God. Well, that really makes her look real innocent, not just a little bit innocent. Now, there's a problem with Matthew Henry's idea here, in my opinion. She wouldn't take an awful oath of imprecation on herself if she were guilty, and so therefore that protects her from rash charges by her jealous husband. Well, I don't know. She might take an awful oath of imprecation on herself, even if she were guilty, because if she just confessed it to her husband when her husband got jealous, wouldn't she be executed? Again, you would have to assume that the husband would turn over to be executed. He might not do that. He might say, okay, you did it. I'm upset with you, but I'll forgive you. I'm not going to turn you over to be executed. And that brings up another interesting legal point. Since she committed adultery, does the husband have a right to hide it from the judges? Now, dealing with my little problem here of why would a guilty wife subject herself to the oath of imprecation, she would do that. She might be inclined to do that, even though it's an awful thing, because of fear of getting executed when her adultery is found out. Colin Delitzsch say this about that, quote, for a really guilty wife would not have made up her mind so easily to take the required oath of purification, as the curse of God under which she came was no easier to bear than the punishment of death. In other words, say Colin Delitzsch, it would be a worse thing to be cursed by God than to die. So that, therefore, a guilty woman is not going to go through this trial. She's just going to confess it and get it over with. She's not going to call the curse of God, even if she faces death. And like I said, she might be able to get out of punishment of death, assuming the husband and the judges let her do it. This brings up another legal problem. What if the husband does that, forgives his wife, hides her adultery from the judges? Is he now then guilty of aiding and abetting a crime? In other words, is the punishment for adultery only if somebody wants to prosecute, or should it be done automatically? Well, that's a decision for a Jewish judge, and I'm not a Jewish judge. Let's look at another commentator talking about how the trial by jealousy prevents unfounded charges by a super jealous husband. Quote, this is Paul E. Kretzmann, quote, the innocent wife, outraged to the quick by the suspicions voiced by her husband, could insist upon this public justification of herself to the deep humiliation of the man unjustly accusing her. This event should not be viewed as being entirely about punishment, but equally about vindication. Now, notice in verse 19, Numbers 5, that the priest dealing in charge of the trial by jealousy ritual assumes innocence. He assumes the woman is innocent. Verse 19, the priest shall have her take an oath and shall say to the woman, if no man has lain with you and you have not gone astray into uncleanness, being under the authority of your husband, be immune to this water or bitterness that brings a curse. So he's assuming she's innocent. But then in verse 20, he says, but if you have defiled yourself, well, then drink the water and be subject to the curse. So the priest is not assuming the woman is guilty at all. She's presumed to be innocent. So let's summarize the purpose of this trial by jealousy. One, to prevent adultery and preserve the sanctity of marriage by making the wife think twice before she strays. Number two, to prove paternity so that once the man knows that his wife's been faithful, he knows his kids are his. And number three, to protect wives from jealous husbands who might go around falsely accusing them. They can vindicate themselves by going through the trial by jealousy. Now, almost all nations had trials by ordeal in this situation. Here's Jameson Fawcett Brown's quotation, quote, from the earliest times, the jealousy of Eastern people has established ordeals for the detection and punishment of suspected unchastity in wives. The practice was deep-rooted as well as universal, and it has been thought that the Israelites, being strongly biased in favor of such usages, this law of jealousies was incorporated among the other institutions of the Mosaic economy in order to free it from the idolatrous rites which the heathens had blended with it. Viewed in this light, it sanctioned by divine authority is a corrected and improved form, exhibits a proof at once of the wisdom and condescension of God. In other words, we don't need to be embarrassed about this trial by jealousy and say, oh, it's just so pagan. It's so old. It's so antiquated. We're modern now. We don't need the blood of Jesus. We don't need trials by jealousy. Well, we're not under the law, so we don't do trials by jealousy anymore. No, but there was a reason for it, and it was a godly reason, and it was perfectly reasonable and understandable from a judicial point of view. We turn now to Numbers chapter 5, verse 15. The man shall then bring his wife to the priest, and shall bring as an offering for her 1/10 of an ephah of barley meal. He shall not pour oil on it, nor put frankincense on it, for it is a grain offering of jealousy, a grain offering of memorial, a reminder of iniquity. Now the offended jealous husband brings his wife to the priest. That's a common priest, not the high priest. And he brings an offering. He brings his wife as well as an offering. The offering is 1/10 of an ephah of barley. 1/10 of an ephah is about 2 quarts, as the NIV note says. It's the same as an omer. Exodus 16:36-9, omer is 1/10 of an ephah. This measurement, 1/10 of an ephah or 2/10 of an ephah sometimes, is used a lot in the measurement of the grain offerings back in Leviticus. We remember that being brought up a lot. One omer, as a matter of fact, which is 1/10 of an ephah, was the amount that the Israelites could gather of manna every day. It's the amount of grain in the meal offering which accompanied the daily morning and evening sacrifice, 1/10 of an ephah, one omer of fine flour. So this amount of barley meal was bought, and why barley? Barley is the grain of the poor, and in fact, more prosperous people wouldn't even eat it. They would use it as fodder for their animals. Why barley meal for the jealousy offering? Here's what Colin Delitzsch say, quote, the questionable repute in which the woman stood, or the ambiguous, suspicious character of her conduct, because such conduct as hers, if shown to be true, did not proceed from the Spirit of God and was not carried out in prayer. Oil and incense, the symbols of the Spirit of God in prayer, were not to be added to her offering. So the incense is a symbol of prayer as the smoke rises up. The oil is the symbol of the Holy Spirit. Of course, those are common symbols. They're not there on that bread because this is a serious situation. It's not good. This is a grain offering of memorial, a reminder of iniquity. The grain offering is to remind people that there is sin being investigated. Now, it does not mean that the woman is guilty of the sin because that has not been proven. But it's a reminder that that the priests are going to investigate whether there is sin or not. It's a memorial offering, but it's not a sin offering. A sin offering was completely different. That's in the book of Leviticus. This is a memorial offering, a jealousy offering. It's not a sin offering. No sin has been proven yet. Here's a quote from a man named Maxey, who has a good article on the internet about the trial by jealousy. He says this, quote, this offering then was symbolic of the husband's suspicions of his spouse and was not an admission of guilt on the part of the wife, a fact that some interpreters have misunderstood. So some people have been saying this is a sin offering. I think Maxey's right. This is not a sin offering. No sin has been proven yet. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown disagrees with that and says this, quote, these ingredients were to be excluded. That's the oil and the frankincense, the oil and the incense. These ingredients were to be excluded partly because it was a solemn appeal to God in distressing circumstances and partly because it was a sin offering on the part of the wife who came before God in the character of a real or suspected offender. I don't know why you would offer a sin offering when sin has not been proven yet. So I don't agree with Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. I think Mr. Maxey is right on that count. We go now to Numbers 5, verses 16 and 17. Then the priest shall bring her near and have her stand before the Lord. And the priest shall take holy water in an earthenware vessel, and he shall take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water. So the woman is now standing before the Lord. That would probably be, well, the rabbis say it's at the eastern gate of the courtyard. I think it's probably at the door of the tabernacle, somewhere around the bronze altar of sacrifice and the bronze laver, the bronze sea, where all that water is. Because the priest has got to take some holy water. Where is he going to get it from? He's going to get it from the laver. The pulpit commentary says this, most likely the phrase bring her near simply meant to bring this accused wife to the door of the tabernacle, not the door of the courtyard, but the door of the tabernacle. But the Jewish rabbis, of course, later said the east gate of the temple court, which is way away on the edge of the courtyard. So the rabbis said that, but I don't think the rabbis are right. I think she's standing before the Lord, before that tabernacle. And I believe she's facing the door of the tabernacle. She's facing the Holy of Holies and the holy place as she stands there. Now the priest takes holy water in an earthenware vessel. That's probably from the laver in the courtyard, the bronze laver. It was called holy water because the water was consecrated for and restricted to sacred uses, in this case, the trial by jealousy. It's the only place in the Bible this phrase appears, holy water. I'm sure Catholics will be disappointed to hear that. Dust from the floor of the tabernacle is put into that water by the priest. Now, what's the symbolism of this? There's a big contrast between holy water and dust. Dust is profane, it's dirty, it's ground under people's feet, whereas the water is holy. So what's trying to be shown here? A big contrast between holy water and dust, or is rather the holy water a complement to the dust and vice versa? Well, here's some options as to the symbolism of the dust. John Gill suggests that dust stands for fleshliness, weakness of the suspected sinner. Adam Clark says that the dirt suggests baseness of the crime of which she had been accused. The dirt is an emblem of vileness and misery, says Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Echoing Clark on that. And so you could say it's holy water because the water is dedicated to finding sin. And of course, that's what holiness does. It exposes sin, and then the dirt could stand for the sin itself. That's reasonable to me. Some people say that actually the dirt adds to the holiness of the water. It doesn't symbolize baseness and the filthiness of the crime, alleged crime, but rather it's holy because it's from the tabernacle, probably from the holy place. The priest couldn't go into the Holy of Holies, but he could go into the holy place and get some dirt from in there. It's interesting that the floor was dirt, which doesn't surprise me. In Exodus, we see nothing of floorboards in the tabernacle. So maybe that's true. Water from the laver and dust from the holy place. We got double holiness there. At any rate, the water and the dirt is put into an earthenware vessel. That earthenware vessel probably had the same symbolism as the dust, if you think the dust stood for vile things. John Gill says the earthenware vessel is, quote, everything mean and vile was in this affair. Some say the earthenware vessel was added to give bitterness to the water. I don't know why that is. Earthenware vessels don't make water bitter in my experience. But anyway, so we got water and we got dirt in an earthenware vessel. I tend to go with the idea that the dirt is supposed to stand for the sin of adultery. We go down to Numbers 5:18. The priest shall then have the woman stand before the Lord and let the hair of the woman's head go loose. So I'm sure he instructs the woman, let your hair down now, madam. So the woman lets her hair down, still standing before the door of the tabernacle, before the Lord. The Lord's in the tabernacle. He's in the Holy of Holies. So she's standing before the Lord as she stands before the tabernacle. She lets her head go loose. What's the options of the symbol of the loose hair? The NIV Study Bible says this is a sign of openness to receive the verdict of the trial. Here's what Mr. Maxey, my internet commentator, says about this, quote, in the solemn place she found herself in with holy priest and holy drinks, the tendency for this woman might be to shrink away, to cover herself with her garments. She is not to do so, however. She is to be presented in a manner of openness before the Lord. So his idea accords with the NIV Study Bible. But here's some other ideas what the hair could stand for. The loose hair could be a sign of judgment and mourning in case she were guilty. But some scholars object to that because the woman has not been found guilty yet. It's just in case she's found guilty, so I don't like that one. John Gill says it could be a sign of her possible immodesty because loose hair often stands for loose women, as it does in many cultures, even in modern times. Not always, but it can be. But again, the woman has not been proven to be modest yet. John Gill says the loose hair could be a sign of her not being under the authority of her husband. Well, now that could be because her husband's kind of turned her over to the court. I don't know. I think probably the NIV Study Bible is right. The loose hair is a sign of openness to receive the verdict. But again, you have to ask yourself, why does loose hair stand for openness to receive a verdict? I'll leave that one for you to decide. I'm not really sure myself. Now, notice that the water that the priest has in his hand is the water of bitterness that brings a curse. Now, it doesn't mean that when the woman drank the water that it was bitter. All it is dirt, is sand, or dirt from the tabernacle floor mixed with the water. Now, I wouldn't advocate drinking something like that, but that's not going to kill you, and it's not going to taste so bitter you can't stand it. The water itself wasn't bitter. Rather, it was capable of producing bitter effects, which effects we'll see in just a minute. So that's why it's called the water of bitterness. We go now to Numbers 5, verses 19 through 22. The priest shall have her take an oath and shall say to the woman, if no man has lain with you, and if you have not gone astray into uncleanness, being under the authority of your husband, be immune to this water of bitterness that brings a curse. If you, however, have gone astray, being under the authority of your husband, and if you have defiled yourself and a man other than your husband has had intercourse with you, then the priest shall have the woman swear with the oath of the curse, and the priest shall say to the woman, the Lord make you a curse and an oath among your people by the Lord's, making your thigh waste away and your abdomen swell. And this water that brings a curse shall go into your stomach and make your abdomen swell and your thigh waste away. And the woman shall say, amen, amen. Now in verse 20, the priest says to the woman, if, and he uses three words to describe her adultery. If you've gone astray, if you defiled yourself, if you have had intercourse. Three words, three verbs piled together to describe the adultery. It's very clear what he's saying here, so there's no chance of misunderstanding. And then he says in verse 21, the Lord make you a curse. In fact, this is as the woman swears with the oath of the curse. She's basically saying, may God make me cursed if I committed adultery. That's the long and short of it. So the woman swears this oath, swears that she imprecates herself, and then the priest says, the Lord make you a curse. That's the usual form of imprecation, as the priest puts a curse on her, and an oath among your people. And usually when you make a curse, something bad's got to happen. What's going to happen bad to the woman if she's guilty? Her thigh is going to waste away, and her abdomen is going to swell. Now, that's problematic because people don't know exactly what that means. The NIV note says the curse is this. Cause you to have a miscarrying womb or barrenness. Well, now that sounds like a good curse. The curse would be either a miscarriage if she was already pregnant, or if she wasn't pregnant, she would be barren and would not get pregnant. Some say this gives precedent for a moral abortion. And what I mean by that, let me read you a quote here from Mr. Maxey, my internet commentator. He said, quote, would God actually permit the death of such an innocent life as a consequence of another sin? One only has to think of the death of the child of David and Bathsheba to find the answer. In other words, yes, sometimes children suffer for the sin of their parents, no question about it. This death of David and Bathsheba's kid, Maxey goes on to say, which should serve as an example to his people of the costliness of one's rebellion against him. It can be quite costly. Such a divine punishment, however, is certainly not even remotely connected with the godless notions pertaining to the mind-numbing slaughter of millions of fetuses today. For anyone to appeal to this passage as justification for the practice of abortion in certain circumstances is appalling. Well, it certainly is. God's judicial punishment is obviously not the same as human murder, which abortion is genocide. However, that NIV translation is not, well, it's not literal. NASB is closer to literal. Your thigh is going to waste away and your abdomen swell. What might that mean besides having a miscarriage? And besides, the problem with saying it's a miscarriage or barrenness is, how do you prove that? How do you know the woman's barren? You got to wait for years to see whether she gets pregnant. I guess if she was pregnant, she'd have a miscarriage right then. But how many times is somebody undergoing this trial by jealousy is going to be pregnant already? This is problematic. So here's another option. Well, before we go on, let's keep pumping this option here that is miscarriage or barrenness. Barrenness would be, or miscarriage, would be a terribly grievous punishment for ancient Near Eastern women. Their whole worth was measured by their ability to give birth, as we know, as the NIV study Bible points out, and so that would be a terrible punishment, a curse. But, as I just said, when are you going to find out? You don't know. If you want to know whether the woman committed adultery or not, you got to sit around and wait till she see if she gets pregnant? I don't think so. So I don't think that's the answer, with all due respect to the NIV. Now, here's a literal suggestion as to what this phrase, thigh waist away and your abdomen swell, might mean. John Gill says it's a supernatural, miraculous working of God. In other words, literally, her stomach would start swelling, and her thigh would correspondingly shrink. And I don't know whether that means thigh waist away relatively compared to the abdomen. It was just a relative shrinking of the thigh as the stomach gets bigger. Or does it mean the thigh waist away at the same time the abdomen swelling? I can see something physical like that happening. I don't have any problem with that. Here's what Adam Clark says about this thigh wasting away and the abdomen swelling. Quote, what is meant by these expressions cannot be easily ascertained. The Hebrew signifies literally thy thigh to fall, as the thigh, feet, etc. were used among the Hebrews delicately to express the parts which nature conceals. The expression here is probably to be understood in this sense. And the falling down of the thigh here must mean something similar to the prolapsus uteri, or the falling down of the womb. And that's where people get the idea that the punishment is the collapse of the womb, can't have a baby. Well, that's very clever. Maybe it just means a tumor in the stomach that could make the stomach get bigger and bigger. I don't know, but whatever it is, it was something serious. And as soon as the woman's stomach started to swell, everybody would know, whoop, she's been a bad girl, catting around on her husband. The woman says amen, amen to this curse that the priest pronounced, imprecated. So be it. So be it. This is the first place in Scripture where this phrase is used. Amen, amen. May I be cursed if I've committed adultery. We go down to Numbers 5, verses 23 and 24. The priest shall then write these curses on a scroll, and he shall wash them off into the water of bitterness. The curse, again, is may your stomach swell and your thigh shrink if you've committed adultery. The priest wrote that down on a scroll. And he shall wash them off into the water of bitterness. The water of bitterness is, of course, not bitter water, but water which causes bitterness. It's water that has some dirt from the tabernacle floor mixed in it. Now he just scrapes off the ink off a scroll that had the curses written. So now the curses are symbolically inside that water. Now the ink was obviously some kind of ink that was not indelible because it could easily wash off. Might have even had to have been specially prepared. I don't know, but the ink washes into the water of bitterness that causes bitterness. Verse 24, then he shall make the woman drink the water of bitterness that brings a curse, so that the water which brings a curse will go into her and cause bitterness. And of course, I assume that means it will cause bitterness, assuming she's guilty. So now that curse is a very part of her inner being. The ink was scraped off of parchment. It could have been a wooden tablet rather than parchment, as Jameson Fawcett Brown says. Parchment is animal skins. But whatever, it's scraped into the water. We go down to Numbers 5, verses 25 through 28. The priest shall take the grain offering of jealousy from the woman's hand, and he shall wave the grain offering before the Lord and bring it to the altar. That's the barley meal with no oil and no incense. He takes a pinch of it and sprinkles it on the altar. And the priest, verse 26, and the priest shall take a handful of the grain offering as its memorial offering, a memorial to remind people of the iniquity that's being investigated. That's what it means, memorial offering, to bring to memory, to bring to mind of what's going on here to the people, and offer it up in smoke on the altar. And afterwards, he shall make the woman drink the water. Notice now he makes the woman drink the water. I'm assuming the woman will do it voluntarily, but if she, for some reason, refused to do it, he could go up there and say, Madam, drink the water. You have to drink it. If she didn't drink it, I assume they would pronounce her guilty of adultery. Verse 27, when he has made her drink the water, then it shall come about, if she has defiled herself and has been unfaithful to her husband, that the water which brings a curse will go into her and cause bitterness. And her abdomen will swell and her thigh will waste away. That doesn't sound like that's a relative wasting away. That sounds like an absolute physical wasting away of the thigh. And the woman will become a curse among her people. But if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, she will then be free and conceive children. So the priest takes the grain. The grain weighs about 2 quarts, which is a tenth of an ephah. And John Gill says that's very heavy. hard for the woman to hold until the priest takes it off her hand. I don't know. Maybe it is. 2 quarts doesn't sound all that heavy to me. Probably about 4 pounds, maybe. But anyway, the priest takes the grain off her head. He does off her hands, and he does the memorial portion on the altar, throws it on the altar. It burns up. Now, what happened to the rest of the grain after the memorial portion is offered? Even with a sin offering, it was baked in one of three ways, and up to three different ways. Cake, griddle, cake, wafer, bits. I forgot the three. I'm trying to remember the three ways. But it was baked in one of three ways, or two of three ways, or three of three ways, and was eaten by the priest. But not here. It doesn't say. I assume it was eaten by the priest. Maybe not. Now, the stomach swells if she's guilty. Now, John Gill says that could be supernatural. In fact, he says that it's not natural causes. And I think Gill is right about that, because how can drinking water with dirt in it cause the swelling of the stomach or the miscarriage or the barrenness, whatever it was? How can drinking water with dirt in it do that? You can drink water right now. Dogs drink dirt with water in it all the time. It doesn't do a thing to them. Now, of course, their saliva is a lot stronger than ours, and their internal immune system and ability to kill germs is stronger than ours, granted, but still, you can drink water with dirt in it, and it's not going to kill you. It's not going to make your stomach swell up. And besides, if it did, then if that was a natural thing that would happen to people that drank dirty water, well, what about the innocent woman that hasn't committed adultery? If she drank dirty water, and dirty water naturally makes your stomach swell up, there would be a false positive, and she would be guilty of adultery when she wasn't guilty of adultery. So I think Gill's exactly right. The swelling of the stomach is supernatural. So the woman, if she passes, she's free and can have children. But now, I wonder what she would think of her husband for putting her through the ordeal when she, in fact, was innocent. Now, maybe she had done some things to arouse the suspicion, and she could say, okay, honey, I understand why you did it. I was chatting up the people in the village at the gate there, chatting up the men a little bit too much. I don't know how much interaction the women had with men back then. I suspect it's probably more than our stereotype allows. So if she was doing something that would cause suspicion, I guess it would be understandable, and hopefully they could work it out. But what happens if she had done a thing, and that husband puts her through that trial of ordeal? Ooh, I bet that things will not be happy at home for a while. And if she has to go through the trial by ordeal, I suspect that she probably did do something to arouse the suspicion, because there's so much disincentive for a man to take his wife through that trial. He's publicly exposed as potentially a cuckold. Or even if his wife is innocent, then he's exposed as being a jealous idiot who drags his wife through a public trial. So he's probably not going to just randomly do that unless there was some reason for the trial to take place. So I'm sure the husband will be happy to find out his wife actually hadn't done anything, even though he thought she might have. Maybe they can work it out. But at any rate, now we know who the kids are. And we know that she hasn't committed adultery. We have probably saved a marriage, because without that trial, the husband would have gone on being jealous and jealous and jealous, and it never would have ended until the marriage dissolved. Numbers 5, verses 29 through 31, and we'll finish up this audio. This is the law of jealousy: when a wife, being under the authority of her husband, goes astray and defiles herself, or when a spirit of jealousy comes over a man and he is jealous of his wife. Those are your two situations. The woman is guilty and defiles herself, or she's not guilty and the man's jealous, even though she is not guilty. Verse 30, when a spirit of jealousy comes over a man and he is jealous of his wife, he shall then make the woman stand before the Lord, and the priest shall apply all the law to her. Moreover, the man will be free from guilt, but that woman shall bear her guilt. Now that's a strange verse, verse 31. Why will the man be free from guilt? Why is this mentioned? Well, here's some options of that. Option number one. Well, actually, this is the only option I have. The man is free from guilt because if he had refused to send his wife through the ordeal, he will be guilty of not allowing the judicial process to play out. He will be guilty of being jealous of a wife without taking it to trial to give her a chance to vindicate herself. But if he gives a chance for her to vindicate herself, well, then he's done his duty and he's free from guilt. If he doesn't insist that she go through the trial, he would be winking at the sin that he thinks the woman is doing. If the wife were in fact guilty, he'd say, well, I don't want anybody to find that out, so I'll just let her keep committing adultery. That wouldn't be good. He'd be guilty for doing that. Or if his wife is not guilty, he would be stoking unnecessary jealousy by refusing to let her vindicate herself, and by saying, I'm not going to let her go through the trial by ordeal. So basically, the trial by ordeal brought an unfortunate situation to a head. By not going through with it, the husband is prolonging that evil situation and thus incurs guilt. But by going through it and being free from guilt, by having the trial by ordeal, the trial by jealousy, by doing that, either the woman is found to be an adulteress and the punishment is done, and that'll stop the confusion of the descendant's bloodlines, or if she's innocent, that'll stop his jealousy. And so that's the end of this chapter. God's establishment of this trial by jealousy is is hard for us in modern times to understand it, but if you examine it and try to put yourself back in that culture, it actually makes an awful lot of sense. So now we're prepared to go to Numbers chapter 6, verses 1 through 27. The whole chapter, we will look at the Nazarite vow and Aaron's famous blessing. May the Lord be with you, and so forth. So I hope to see you next audio. I hope you enjoyed this one.